wave, the economic causes and social consequences of financial consolidation in the United States, published by Sharpe in 1999. He's also the co-editor of Seeking Shelter on the Pacific Rim, Financial Globalization, Social Change, and the Housing Market, also published by Sharpe in 2001. He also has over 100 articles and chapters in the book. And today we see his title on the screen. So welcome, Gary.
Right, so I should go for about 40 minutes?
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much for coming, and it's a great honor to be here and speaking at this legendary space, and good to be back in L.A. I'm going to get right to my talk, because I've got a lot to say, and Bob has got a lot to say, and we'll try to get somewhere by the time we're done today. Here's my map. Those of you who can't quite see, I apologize. I use PowerPoint in part because we can look at some of the pictures that are relevant, and in part because it helps me to organize what I want to say. I'm going to break down into several pieces. One is just an introduction to be sure that I get to some of the main themes before we get into the meat of it. Then the third, fourth, and fifth sections actually are kind of one whole, and they'll lay out where we got to, how the subprime crisis arose, where it came from. We'll then do a timeline on the crisis, and then we'll look at some of the ways in which policies have been tried and failed, and why thus far. And if time permitting, we'll say a little bit about ways of restoring what banking is. So basically, to start then, there's three narratives that have been shaping understanding about what's going on. The first narrative is this idea that there's something wrong with the borrowers who got into subprime loans. There's an overextension of the housing market, and misbegotten regulations, in particular the Community Reinvestment Act, combined with people's willingness to try to reach beyond their means, led us into the morass we're in. A second kind of theme that we see, and these are not mutually exclusive, is the idea of greed and overreach by megabanks. We see a lot of discussion of Charles Poor Kindleberger's book, Manias, Panics, and Crashes, and there's a lot of talk about the Minsky moment. And thirdly, we see some people really looking at the subprime and financial crisis as something like the end of days. U.S. profligacy coming to roost, over-indebtedness, over-consumption, SUVs, and since I'm here in L.A., I think you can all understand Jack Nicholson courtside for the Lakers, that's got to be a piece of it. And then Manny Ramirez is a Dodger. If that's not a sign of the end of days, I don't know what is. Now, just to show, let's go through these things, because the first thing I want to mention is a couple of things from the last several days, respectively Wall Street Journal and The Times. Here is HSBC trimming its U.S. consumer unit, and what I'd like you to do is maybe we'll make these things available, but just this article about how HSBC is pulling back from U.S. consumer lending, throwing in the towel, et cetera. HSBC, reading down a bit, had already ceased its provision of auto loans, now it'll stop making personal loans. It comes at a moment when U.S. banks are under pressure to lend more money to consumers, and it could signal that HSBC believes the U.S. has a long way to go. Okay, so there's one thing. Interestingly, in the New York Times, a couple of days later, Floyd Norris picks up that theme and talks about this, and basically contextualizes by saying this is the deal that launched subprime, the deal when HSBC bought Household International essentially got into the subprime. Again, I won't bother you with all the details of the article, but it's essentially a story about how when this happened in 2002, it signified the significance of the subprime market as being a respectable business. Household was about to fail, and I might note, under pressure from community-based organizations that were taking it to court and suing it. Basically, HSBC buys it for $484 million and settles claims that it was predatory. At the time, it's Richard Cole, of New Century said, "It's refreshing when a highly qualified suitor sees value. I should note that New Century subsequently went bankrupt, one of the subprimes. But this week, however, HSBC conceded defeat. It's going to close the offices, and they wish they hadn't done it. There is some notion that they were providing assurance that the notion was that HSBC's purchase had provided the assurance that let the whole subprime thing get going in the first place. They are who you should blame. Now, this is actually very satisfying when the New York Times picks the finger. So the answer is, attack HSBC. It's that simple. But actually, I put these quotes up here because I'd like to signal the fact that this notion that something that happened in 2002 launched all of this is completely misbegotten. And here in the history department at this august university, we have to set this aside. Now, basically, subprime lending is rooted in the sort of financial exploitation that the Community Reinvestment Act tries to block, not to foster. Mega banks were perpetrators, not victims. That's first. Secondly, you know, financial crises do recur, going to that Kindle Bergerian theme. But which history is really repeating itself? You know, financial crises did not lead to worldwide meltdowns. When we had the Latin American crisis in 82, the Mexican crisis in 94, the Asian crisis in 97. But it's happening now, and so why? The other thing is that regarding the end of days, one of the things you really see here is this notion of borrowing through the roof. And here's just a graph from the flow of funds account of net borrowing as a share of GDP. My point here is just to show you that, yes, it's high and it's been high, but it's not like we actually haven't been there before. This is actually the early 80s here. Just saying that this is not something like we're all going to be in some space we've never been in, nor is this the curse of Mike Piazza, although that's my personal theory, actually. But this is something about the limits of the post-hegemony that the U.S. has enjoyed in the neoliberal era. And so basically, if the U.S. is indeed the global lender of last resort, why is it failing now? To respond to these last two points, we're really going to have to get into the work of Hyman Minsky and the implications of that work for our present subject. He liked to say the sky did not fall. The sky did not fall in 1982 or in other years, and everything was rescued. And it didn't this year, and we need to, you know, the sky did fall this year, and we need to talk about why. So basically, the crisis invites an interpretation that blames victims and concludes that governments failed. The roots of it, though, really are in the bank's strategic reorientation in the neoliberal era and their patterns of racial exclusion in lending markets, and those are not patterns that started in 2002. Working with this gives us the idea that we cannot fit all financial crises into one pattern. Instead, to think clearly, we have to understand the historical and institutional context. And finally, we have to really acknowledge that banking and finance is broken. We have to really go back to the roots and rethink what a bank is and what it should be. We can do this on elitist grounds or in populist grounds or other grounds, but it has to be done. So, just briefly, to refresh our memories, what is it that banks are supposed to do? It's very simple. You come right down to it. In the essence, they're supposed to provide credit and supply credit and provide liquidity. In supplying credit, they take on default risk. In providing liquidity, they take on liquidity risk. It's that simple. The non-bank financial system, the derivatives markets and all of that, from the viewpoint of the non-financial system, in principle, is there to provide insurance for those who are taking risks in the other sector. Now, it's got a lot further out than that, and the whole literature and discussion about financialization tells us that. But in essence, that's what it's supposed to do. There are tensions between the returns and risks involved in undertaking these actions. Essentially, when one institution both makes credit and then takes on credit risk, that institution is going to have a kind of automatic decelerator leading it to worry about risk when it goes too far. Similarly, on liquidity. And if we have the principle that the institution that bears risk, that makes risk, bears risk, we have one set of possibilities. We got so far afield in part because we had a separation between risk creation and risk bearing. Regulators in principle should balance. And just to say that there's different ways to have functional systems. There's Anglo-American and East Asian approaches to finance. I'll just mention that, you know, these systems can work a lot of different ways. And I'll just note that basically which ones we choose depend a lot on the structure of law and on what's defined as a business contract under the law in our different systems. Now, let's get into the crisis and where it came from. I want to start with the transformation of banking really going into the 1970s. With the end of Bretton Woods, banks and thrifts were in deep trouble. There was disintermediation, high interest rates, and the emergence of competitors. If we think of banks as having two sides of their balance sheets, they were under attack in the post-Bretton Woods era on both sides. On their liability side, their more well-off customers were flying to money market mutual funds and other instruments. On their asset side, they were losing their blue-chip customers. Commercial paper and other markets were really opening up in ways that had not been seen. And so essentially they tried to offset in a variety of ways. They had to hit the borrowed fund markets, and they went into loans to Latin America in particular, assured by Walter Wriston's comment that countries don't go bankrupt. Now, there is immense amounts that we could say about all of that at this end of the discussion, but I'm going to telescope it right now just in the interest of time. Essentially, what happens next, right, is that Wriston is wrong. By the way, it's interesting to think of John Reed, his successor's comment that a bank is a factory, also worth thinking of. But we then run into all kinds of crises, these three, the oil patch, the Latin American savings and loan crisis, continental Illinois fails, and essentially we enter this period of chaos, actually orchestrated by one Mr. Volcker, who's in a very key spot right now, and including many deregulation acts. I'm not going to get into the specifics of those, but I just want to highlight that in that process, it looked for a while as if banks were gone, and instead there was a reinvention. This reinvention had to do first with their discovery that they had to recapture and compete for their upscale customers, corporations, and the relatively well-off asset-possessing customers, upscale retail banking. That was something that we're going to see because that's part of the story. In addition, though, it's fair to say that the housing finance system was destroyed. And while banks themselves maintained their viability as credit-making and holding institutions, the savings and loan system was a goner. And basically, what was created instead was a safe securitization system. This was the creation of the mortgage-backed security system. And here's how it looked. Basically, you had a mortgage originator, a thrift or a bank or even other institutions could suffice. Essentially, mortgage loans were originated, and once originated, if they qualified, they'd be sold off into a pool. Now, at that point, plain vanilla loans is what qualified. These were loans that were guaranteed safe, both because they were at least, there was a loan of no more than 80%. Of the value of the home, so there was equity in the home, there's collateral in the home, and there was limits on 30% and so on the interest that was carried by the borrower. As such, these mortgages were as safe as houses, indeed they were essentially houses, and they were bundled and sold, and that mortgage-backed securities market there was initially subscribed by trust funds, pension funds, and others that could maturity match, and in a time of global crisis, looked like a very safe bet. This market became the biggest in the world by the end of the 1980s. Just to show you how fast this system adapted, here's a graphic that shows you the blue line descending like a meteor to the ground is the savings institutions line. What's rising there in particular are the federal agencies because the federal government would step in, and for those mortgages that qualified as plain vanilla, they would essentially guarantee them. Now, this was a guarantee of an agency of the government, not of the government, but everybody understood that in the end, Uncle Sam stood behind these protocols. You can see that it became very popular. Notice that banks moved, but not that aggressively. And here's what happened to the system as a whole. I got just two graphs here and two lines. The red line is the line of real GDP growth, and what you see there is that, you know, of course, there's this bouncing around cyclically. But I want to mention here that 1982 and 83, here's the creation of that new system. And what I want to commit to your attention here is that the dark blue line, which is the line of the thrifts, the real growth of mortgages, actually exceeds that of GDP already by the time of the actual crisis. This thing adapted fast. Now, it's always been true that housing remains one of the most volatile components of GDP, but in this case, you can see how quick it was. I also want you to notice that it always tends to over-adjust, and the other thing is you'll see there toward the end the adjustment toward the crisis itself. Now, let's go to the next component of this thing, racial inequality and its march from exclusion to exploitation. The federal government itself actually sanctioned redlining and racial discrimination against minorities being able to have any access to credit to use to acquire and increase their wealth. This was from the 1930s onward policy. Of course, this was fought as one of the many branches of the civil rights movement. The civil rights movement transplanted into the cities with a dose of white flight became the community reinvestment movement. Laws were passed as activists who couldn't get loans in their working class neighborhoods and lower income and segregated neighborhoods fought to get credit, especially to buy homes. And those laws were passed in the mid-70s. Banks improved, actually. I document that a little bit in that 99 merger book. But basically, there was then a transformation. Racial exclusion, the refusal to make loans, was turned into another thing. Now, this had to do with the fact that we were an increasingly unequal society, and on the bottom of that society, there were more and more people who were cut out of the game. And basically, they were cut out of the game, and a term was coined in geography, financial exclusion. They were subject to financial exclusion. But the fact of the matter was is that they were dripping in finance and banking. They had to take care of lots of monetary affairs, money orders, and transfers across borders. The remittance market, for example, in about 2001, a partner called Orozco showed that banks only had about 3% of that market. Banks wanted in, and there was money at the lower end of the market. So they developed lots of products, the ones just referred to in that article. Payday loans, consumer durable credit, debit cards, and subprime loans. Now, subprime loans initially, I've got a few pictures here. I think I'll skip them, I think, in the interest of time. I think I'm going to need the minutes. Just really showing you here how, if this is the part of the city where black folks live and Latinos, Asians, this is the part of the city where white folks live. We had this kind of transformation where basically over time there was the growth of centralized finance and then the withdrawal of banks and the substitution of informal banking firms. But again, that picture, we could dally over more if this is a crowd of geographers. But let's move on and just mention that what was really happening with subprime loans was the following. Let me go back a second. In this part of the inner city, there were people who had migrated to cities and been able to eke out and even have good lives. People in South Central LA, African Americans who'd worked for Kaiser and so on. People who could build and sustain families. And some of those folks were homeowners. We then roll into the 1960s and 70s when basically black and Latino labor to some large extent becomes a reserve labor supply in many cities around the country and in this state. And to that extent, then families come on hard times, and we have the emergence of the prison industrial complex. And suddenly, you got somebody in jail, and you got a kid that needs to be fed, and you got an unwed mother, and you got grandma or grandpa at that point that owns a home and could use a little bit of money. And you have the emergence of the subprime lending market as a second mortgage business in the hood. It is created in the hood. I teach in Riverside, and one of the projects I had the kids do back in the late 90s for urban economics was to go and work with some of the senior citizens groups and have them pick up the mail that came to their door as they were solicited for these loans on the east side, Howard, as you will remember. And so that was where these things came from. And basically, they were made in redlined areas. By 1998, once they were good enough for that, then they were commonly made, increasingly made to people of color anyway who wanted to own homes. One-third of all mortgage loans by 1998 were being made to blacks, and a fifth to Latinos and to lower-income folks. This business grew by 900% between 1993 and 1999, as you'll note, well in advance of that 2002 purchase of that HSB Household International by HSBC. Other kinds of mortgage lending fell. The inner city became a kind of pool for this sort of lending. Payday loans also, for the record, also exploded. So what we had here was a business model for subprime lending. High loan rates, high application fees, high penalty fees, with short maturities. Basically, what had been worked out was the mathematics of a loan that was not going to be viable in the longer run, but that could be profitable in the short run, especially if it could be moved off the balance sheet. Now, I'll just pause here that in the thrift crisis, which found me at the Brookings Institution, I'd worked with a fellow called Bob Lighton, and we had worked out, we'd spent a lot of time thinking about banking risks in those days, and one of those was recourse risk, which was something like if I make you a loan, basically, and then I sell that loan to you, the recourse risk is I make a promise to you as a business contract, and if the loan doesn't deliver, we have a problem. You have an issue with me. You have recourse to me for the terms and conditions that were not satisfied. That was well understood in the thrift crisis, just for the record, much as it was completely forgotten in the go-go 2000s. But just to say that you could handle recourse risk, it seemed, in a variety of ways, in particular by having markets that would insure against excess default risk. This turned into credit default swaps. And by the way, why are they called credit default swaps? Well, so they don't have to be overseen and regulated by the insurance industry, just for the record. So basically, we then have this kind of situation where we have the move toward the opening of this market. Banks didn't want them on their balance sheets, but large investment banks provided $80 billion in 98 and 99. Wall Street insurers backed these things up, and this was documented in the Wall Street Journal in the year 2000. Large bank holding companies acquired subprime subsidiaries so that they could get access to these fees. And just three here, First Union bought Money Store, Citicorp bought Associates First Capital, and they then that gave them the vehicle, by the way, for launching City Financial in 20 nations. And then HSBC, as noted, finalized its purchase of Household International in 2003. What was happening here was the growth of credit across the board. Now, just one picture here. What we have here is a picture from the Federal Reserve's Survey of Consumer Finances. Every 3 years, they take a snapshot. And in the snapshot, they do a number of slices in their own conservative way. And one of those slices is basically lowest fifth of incomes to next to middle to highest. And I commend this to your eyes. Just take a look at the two left bars are debt, and the two rightmost bars are credit, are assets in every case, housing and non-housing, and respectively, mortgage and non-mortgage, financial and non-financial. But basically, what I would like you to just notice is that there was a rocketing upward of debt in the lower portions of the nation's household. They were targeted. This is a summary, 89 to 2004. Of course, if we slice it nearer in time, it gets more dramatic. So all the machinery is in place. You have, for a robust industry, you have lenders, borrowers, bundlers, underwriters, a market demand, growing numbers of hedge funds and private equity funds, an abundant liquidity guaranteed by the position of the United States. Here's the growth of hedge funds. I won't bore you with details, but just to say they were getting bigger fast. And once this thing evolved, essentially, Here's the growth of mortgage-related securities. The figure there, this is from Eric Tumoin, who's at Cal State Bakersfield. That figure is $5 billion. But all kinds of other stuff started to go into this paper, which was opaque. Here's the other stuff. Here's his figure as well. About $3 billion there. So lots of stuff gets cooked into this. They imagined they were creating a new form of banking, a passive financial intermediary that would not be able, would not have to declare what it owned, because its combination was smart enough that it could beat all of the derivatives markets. And essentially what we saw was then the rise of the SIVs, the structured investment vehicles, which were a kind of cousin by a strange transformation of the mortgage-backed securities. This picture looks an awful lot like the other one, but there's a few key differences. One is that we now have not mortgage-backed securities, all safe and sound with plain vanilla, but we now have collateralized debt obligations, mixing all kinds of things in there, and cocktails of obligations and payment streams. And then rather than being backed by pension funds and insurance companies and the like, we now have short-term money market borrowing, because essentially what was shown was that whoever held this paper could leverage it to ungodly levels, therefore making immense rates of return by essentially lending long, lending high, and borrowing short. Now, that market right there, that's your asset-backed commercial paper market right there. So as the bubble grows, essentially, you have this vehicle that's all set up to go with the fact that housing prices are rising, and in some areas, and in other cases, incomes are falling, and subprime loans are a necessity. I've got the numbers here, 8% in 2001, up to 14% subprime in 2004-05, up to 32% subprime, and 45% variable rate in 2006. In California, as we know, in those years, about half the loans made without zero down payment. And here's the kind of a story of what's going on. We had the, on the one hand, median household income rises cyclically, except for that very last recovery where we had the jobless recovery. And then we have homeownership rate rising, and the homeownership rate rising while the income is stalled, of course, means that housing prices compared to income are going to be rising. And you see it here. Again, the dotted line shows you the rising household, home value to income ratio for the United States. The other dark line just really shows you new home price to existing home price. The point made there is that it's not that we were building mansions necessarily. Mansions were getting squeezed, as we know in California, but what was happening was that essentially prices were running amok. So we had the pressure on housing markets in hot areas to increase in value while not tipping against the unsustainable, what we're going to soon becoming unsustainable housing price to income ratios. And the housing market just comes apart. First the subprime paper, and then the overall market as the prices collapse, and then the securities. Here's a graph from a new study out of the University of Virginia that essentially just shows what we know, which is that in California, I won't bore you, and people don't have a real good view of the screen, so I'll be quick. That in California we have an extremely high housing value to income ratio, and that's part of our problem. Here's something more interesting and easier to see. This is the Case-Shiller Housing Index values. Now, this is the current thing that's used by mostly for to talk about what's going on. And notice that the housing, real housing prices are rising, and they get above 10%. But notice that in the nation as a whole, there's not a tremendous rise. However, in isolated markets, here I've selected Phoenix and Las Vegas. They only cover 20 cities, by the way, the Case-Shiller. You can see the real bump a couple years there where they're 25% rising. But I want you to contrast that with the situation of the diamonds here. There's the Detroit-Cleveland housing market that was such a battleground in the Obama campaign. And notice that there what we see is actually housing prices falling by the subprime period. Here's an L.A. and here's a California story. Three cities picked up in Case-Shiller. You and L.A. all know about that early bump we had, and so there's, you know, there's the story there. Essentially, we then go into the crisis, and we have basically, this is a heat picture. This is February 2008. The more red, the hotter the foreclosure action is. This is actually put together by a company called Realty Track that markets foreclosures, so that heat means good for them, and blue means cold. Now, they refined their maps, and I want to show you one. Here's they've changed them, too, because actually they found out that gray they thought meant neutral, but gray just meant that actually it was rural, and they didn't cover it. So here's they do it state by state now. Now check this out. This is May 2008, and notice that California is muito hot. And muito quente, excuse me. Let's do the proper Portuguese. And but just, okay, now look, and then this is going to be January 2009. Now, it looks the same, doesn't it? Except here, the hottest is that 1 in 119 units are in foreclosure, and here it's 1 in 76. So it's getting hotter, people, big time. And this foreclosure thing goes through and hits everybody terribly. Here's Orange County. You can guess where the Sanchez sisters are from by just taking a look at that and where the historical redlining pattern has been and where that TV show that we all hate was filmed. And then negative equity homes. As I just commend this to your attention, over 50% negative equity, especially, you know, in Sacramento, the hood is like right here. And basically the hood extended with a lot of development marketed to heavily minority buyers, and these are now the places that are way deep underwater. So let's then go to this, the timeline and some things to, you know, what's going on. And, you know, about 2007, February, we wake up to this. We then have a series of crises, and, you know, Bear Stearns goes, its SIVs go down. Liquidity crisis happens. The Great Northern thing lets us know in September that it's global. And in fall, the Treasury comes up initially with a Superfund idea that soon, abandoned. The federal funds, the Federal Reserve starts to get into it. We have the Bush administration's now forgotten tax rebate program. And then Bear Stearns' failure in March 2008. Well, there was a brief respite where it looked, oh, and by the way, this is the commercial paper market melting down. And this is specifically the asset-backed commercial paper is the one that falls off a cliff there in September 2007. From that point forward, the Fed has essentially gradually moved the entire money market over to its balance sheet. In the discussion, I have a graphic if you're interested, but it's pretty impressive. Essentially, we then have what seems like a respite where there's growth for a little while in the second quarter, but then all hell breaks loose in September, October 2008. Lehman Brothers goes down. The liquidity markets go deeper into the tank. The interbank market actually freezes. Fannie Mae goes into receivership. Washington Mutual fails, taken over by Chase. The analysts take a look at Wachovia's balance sheet and says, wow, this looks really similar. And within minutes, their price collapses as well. They're taken over by Wells Fargo, much to its regret. And then AIG goes into receivership. Henry Paulson then stands with his finger in as many dikes as he could figure out or not. And we then had all these things to do with that rescue fund, but the Fed doing more and more as we go forward. Now, basically, what's happening at the same time, what then is clearly being triggered is, see, all that was the subprime crisis, but we now have the banking crisis. And just to give you a quick picked on what was happening there. We have a collapse of liquidity. Well, I'll show you in pictures. The collapse of liquidity that basically those markets, it's not that Citi and then wanted to bring that paper back on board, but they had no choice. They were financing that stuff with asset-backed commercial paper, and literally every liquid market in the world was melting down. Now, here's my kind of graphic. What we have over here is the equity market, and on the right we have the operational bank channel. And this was kind of the plan. This was the bad bank model. What was supposed to happen here is that you declare your loan losses. The equity markets say, aha, I see that there's things going on. The bank says, yes, there are. We're short of capital. But, you know, we declared our losses. We are good students, and we deserve more capital. We're going to get that capital. Meanwhile, we're going to take it easy on loan making. We will then basically see where we can get capital, and let's go to sovereign wealth funds, China, Warren Buffett, wherever we can find it. That will stabilize return and reduce our risk. and let us go forward. Now, that was the plan, because the markets weren't having any. You know, these were the markets that were turning away from them. So what you basically need was something that would have been very familiar to Koreans in, oh, like about 1998, 99, when there was vultures buying up Korean banking shares. But couldn't happen to a nicer country, now that it came across the water. Now, basically, the what went wrong? Well, you know, people didn't believe the banks. Somehow it happened. Have these people actually declared all their losses? And so essentially, rather than this nice outcome where they return to recovery, what happened was the markets got more worried and their suitors began to feel ripped off. So equity prices sink further. What happens next in the drama? Well, TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Program. And basically, this notice placed the role that was previously played by China and the sovereign wealth funds. See, TARP is there. And the idea was just as before. Give them the money, let them figure out their stuff, stabilize return, reduce risk, and then they'll go back to normal, meanwhile taking it easy. Only thing they forgot was that this was a political program. And so there's a little thing called political pressure to increase loans that basically made this non-viable. And of course, on top of this, we have the appearance of the dread economic slowdown, which basically comes into our story here in two ways. First of all, it causes more loan losses. And second of all, as the banks pull away from the lending scene, that in turn amplifies the slowdown. So we're in a serious crisis worthy of another book, I think, by Bob Brenner, for sure. And so we have a government simultaneously confronting a meltdown in global employment production, short and long-term policy questions about banking, housing, and so on. There's short-term and long-term questions. I think I've got about 5 minutes left, and so I'm going to kind of go to some of the problems with what policy's been trying to do and why it's failed. We'll make these notes available, and just to say we're going to talk about first about U.S. hegemony and its role. It's important to see that. Secondly, why the Fed and Treasury efforts to fix the system didn't work. And lastly, we'll spend a couple of minutes about Minsky and why his lender of last resort stuff didn't work. Now, first about the global situation. We had the United States as a global liquidity sink during almost the entirety of the neoliberal era. That current account deficit meant a capital account surplus, and it meant that we were a global liquidity sink. Funds were flowing in, and firms themselves could come up with liquidity-intensive strategies. That's exactly the whole point of offloading. You got somewhere to sell to, and you can make your margin. You can't do that if you're sitting in Brazil, but you can sure do it if you're sitting in the United States in this global epoch. And so basically what we saw was the elephantization of Wall Street compared to everybody else. Now basically this shows you, this is the Business Week 1000. They don't do this anymore, but in May they used to collect the 1,000 largest firms by capitalization. And essentially back in 1989 when they first did it, we were all turning Japanese. This was just before the crisis in Japan. But by the time we get to 2004, the last time they run it, basically Wall Street had dominated everything. The idea of the U.S. as a safe haven had really emerged and been sustained. Asia in crisis, Latin American crisis, 9/11, all of that pushing us toward the embrace of the United States securities markets. Now, you may remember, some of you are young enough to remember a game called Pac-Man. And the better way to see this graphic is as follows. Purple is Japan and light blue is the United States. This is 1989, 97, 2001, 2004. I think they call that scoreboard, people. Wall Street looked like it won. And what does that mean, of course, was that essentially here, this one here is the nominal borrowing rate for, this is the nominal 30-year mortgage rate, continually downward during that whole period of the buildup of debt. That's called hegemony right there. Now, that's hegemony in a very peculiar way, but this keeps the homeowner's debt obligation ratio, which is this very conservative Fed measure of how much money you owe, much lower than that of renters. Now, another possibility, okay, thesis number two on policy of the three I'm going to do, is that there's moral hazard. There's something wrong with the banking system. We're overbanked. The idea is that you had these gamblers, we weren't regulating well, we still got way too many banks. We used to have 14,000, we still got more than 8,000. It's too much. And actually, you know, what's happened here is that the Wall Street mega banking complex remains a source of competitive advantage, but it's not efficient enough. It's not like Canada that has like six banks. We have 8,000. We got to get down to that. And so what we have to do is to rescue U.S. competitive advantage. Consolidation for efficiency. That's why Henry Paulson gives so much of that TARP money to people to encourage them to merge with weaker local banks at all levels and scales. Now, I don't have time to get into that in detail, but basically, the banking system in this theory has been disadvantaged by excess capacity. That explains the non-competitive and wasteful and risky people making loans, so let's clean things up. Okay, Ben Bernanke supports this view. I won't pause here to say that Ben thinks we got to do this too. Robert Shiller also thinks, by the way, he's been very active. He's making a lot of money from the Case Shiller, but he wants to make more because Mr. Shiller wants to open up a new index market. So I think he must have his sights on an island in the Caribbean, and maybe like Cuba. But in any case, the idea is that we had a risk creation and distribution system. We just didn't get the risk assessment and the risk management right. He had an article 2 days ago in in the Financial Times, if you want further amusement from Mr. Shiller. But Mr. Irrational Exuberance, okay, so this is what we're seeing. Now, what has happened in terms of consolidation? Well, let me show you. This is the 25 largest U.S. mega banks in 1997. Now, essentially, I'm making an argument here in part about the corruption of what we call banking. Now, notice that it's like very small. It's a smooth, like a cross-country ski kind of a slope, right? Okay, now, what happens between 97 and 2004? All kinds of mergers. Now, without detail, this is my book, right, in part, right? So, or after the book, actually. So, what's left is this, very jagged. But what happens after 2004? Well, that was we're tracking here the 25 largest banks as of 97. This is what happens. The very large get very much larger. Different way of seeing this. Here we're just going to take the 25 largest in every year and just rank them. So we're substituting in new firms all the time. And what I'd like you to notice here is that from about number 9 or number 7 on, number 8, I guess, they're all about the same size. There's always like a $40 billion bank. There's always a $30 billion bank. It might be in Cincinnati. It might be in Florida. But basically what's different, though, is this elephantization of the very big. Had a KPFK interview last fall where we were talking about Wells Fargo, which is just here, and the question was, will Wells Fargo survive? I said, maybe not, because, you know, they're not exactly too big to fail. Now, what happens between June 2008 and actually December 2008 after the end? So that's the period where TARP is implemented. Well, actually, Wells gets big enough. Congratulations. They're now in the upper cluster. And basically, it just pushes everything else. Who got the TARP money? Okay, that's who got the TARP money. Now, the missing places, by the way, are foreign-owned banks, just in case you didn't think that Economic National was not alive and well, and is very much alive. And basically, just to say that, but see, the question I would say is, how much of this is actual banking defined as somebody taking a telephone call, assessing creditworthiness, and deciding whether it's a good risk? Not much, my friends. This is a whole other thing. And so essentially, this part number 3, why has policy failed? We're going to get to Minsky now just a little bit, and I think I'm going to have to kind of talk you through Minsky. I'm going to talk you through it with a couple of things. Essentially, the markets misassessed risk. They were treating, I know I'm a little bit over, but if you can give me a couple minutes, I'm sorry. The markets were treating extremely risky paper as completely safe. This graph here shows commercial paper. This is asset-backed commercial paper. As a percentage, now this is on the right-hand scale, there's zero. As a percentage of the return on federal funds, essentially iterates to zero. It is judged as safe as federal funds by the market. Okay, that's kind of surprising. Because now what's happened, and I'll just say words about Minsky. Minsky's story is about financial instability and how it arises. And essentially, in Minsky's story, as I looked at it, it's set up like this, in just a couple of minutes here. We have like the three sectors. There's the banking sector, households, and firms. And if you kind of take a look at the balance sheets and just focus on the liability side, where we have firm net worth, very important and built into Hayek's theory, essentially, that the lender of last resort can step in and stabilize the system before anything else goes wrong. What essentially he was counting on was the fact that U.S. corporations have about one-third equity on balance. Households have like 20 to 15%. In the latest consumer survey finance by the Fed, it was around 13%. And the banks had the least equity. They were the most leveraged sector. So essentially, as you're pushing the economy toward the brink in any kind of downfall, the sector that is most sensitive to the fall of its asset prices and to the deterioration of its business is the banks. So by intervening in the banking sector, you can stabilize them and stabilize everything else. What happens, and see if I got a picture here, and I'll make this my last picture, what happens is that banks, who were supposed to be the most risky units, no longer were. So here's the banks. They were on the far right before with the most leverage. But now what do we have? SIVs, which are essentially infinitely leveraged. And then subprime households that are also, if they bought with no down payment, infinitely leveraged. But then if they went in and lost money, as all those places in Sacramento and everywhere else have done, they are now negative infinitely leveraged. And so essentially, you have a crisis of solvency, of cash flow, and of value outside of the banking sector. It's no longer contained. And so you really got to take a look at measures to solve this problem that you never had to do before, and measures to really take a look at what this sector has done to create all that. And I'll just say the words, and maybe in discussion we'll have time to say that we need a socially responsive banking system that takes us back to the fundamental economic purposes of the banking system within the larger economy, to think that the financial system is a continuing source of competitive advantage of the United States in our global economy is the path to madness. I will leave it there.